Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. John Andrus. Today we're going to be talking about a recent case in the Equality Court involving Julius Malema. We're also going to be talking about where the battle over NHI sits at the moment, and we're going to be talking about education funding, some attempts to reform it, and some shortfalls that government is experiencing. Let's get into it. The Equality Court on Wednesday, sitting in the Western Cape High Court, found EFF leader Julius Malema guilty of hate speech and guilty of incitement for some remarks he made at a rally in 2022. Malema was talking about an altercation that he had had with someone outside of a school. I think it was a school in Brackenfell where the EFF was protesting alleged racism. Malema at the rally said, "Tell that white man to try me," referring to, I think, someone who had threatened to take him to court. "I've come many times here in the Western Cape appearing in a court case because no white man is going to beat me up. And I call myself a revolutionary the following day. You must never be scared to kill. A revolution demands that at some point there must be killing because the killing is part of a revolutionary act." The South African Human Rights Commission got a lot of complaints after this, and they took Malema to court for these remarks, saying that it constituted hate speech. The judge in the case said that Malema's comments had constituted an exhortation to kill white males who had participated in the incident at Brackenfell High School and to kill or respond violently to any other persons who engaged in racist behavior towards members of the second respondent, the EFF, in the future. The judge said the EFF should be held jointly liable as the party endorsed and supported these statements in the media advisory, which it issued in the proceedings. It said that the law made provision for dealing with racists and that essentially responding with violence to racists was an act of vigilantism. The EFF and Malema have been ordered to, I think, pay costs, and the Human Rights Commission was seeking an apology and a fine of, I think it was 500,000 rand from Malema. The EFF has said that they are going to be appealing the decision, and so this fight is not over at all yet. So we don't entirely know, you know, whether he's going to be found guilty of this. But John, obviously, I have no great love for Malema and his often racist, inflammatory, violent remarks that he makes from time to time. Most infamously, of course, when he said, "I'm not calling for the genocide yet," which I think is you know, one of those things that should live in infamy. But I do always get a little bit nervous when the government starts telling you what you can and can't say. What do you make of this ruling? Do you think that this is incitement? Do you think that this is hate speech? What do you think of hate speech laws in general?
Well, I think one of the things I take away from this is that Julius Malema has been living kind of a charmed life so far. Things kept going right for him. Nothing would stick, no legal challenge. And, you know, he just seemed to be going from strength to strength. And so to see him now suffering a rare legal defeat is actually quite interesting, especially because it's on a topic where previously he has had victories, such as over the decision to allow him to continue singing the Kill the Boer song, you know, which caused a lot of trouble with the US that doesn't like that sort of thing very much. But now we see a court here saying, well, hold on, you know, maybe you are going a little far. And for me, that is really the most interesting thing here, is to see that Julius Malema has been right on the line, separating from legality from illegality, and he's managed always to stay on the right side of that line so far. And now, for the first time, it seems that his luck has left him, and he has been found to be on the wrong side of the line. And that's, I think, quite important, not just in terms of our laws, but also politically, because the EFF, you know, as one of the comrade parties, together with the ANC and MK, is not looking too healthy at the moment. And I think this kind of court defeat sort of weakens it further. I think it might have been Gareth van Onselen who pointed out that it's hard to remember the last time that there was a big public stunt that the EFF pulled that generated them positive attention from the kinds of people who are inclined to support the EFF. Now, when was the last time that a Clicks store was trashed? When was the last time that, you know, EFF members fought with school children outside of school? It's been a while. And now you've got sort of not just the lack of public spectacle, but also this legal defeat. In terms of hate speech laws, it's like one of the most difficult areas of law, I think, to parse and to understand, because it is so much open to interpretation of how likely a certain speech act is to result in harm to another person. And we, I think, at the Institute tend to err on the side of more free speech rather than less free speech. And so, as you say, you know, we feel a little uncomfortable when a court says you can't say that. But maybe in this case, you know, with the line between legality and illegality being so narrow, it's quite useful to be shown where that dividing line sits exactly. So I think this is a useful case, and it seems to me that the Equality Court, I think, came to the right decision. And probably the EFF also recognizes that, because their defense or sort of their statement in response to the ruling was not really addressing the facts of the matter, but talking quite a lot about decoloniality and what have you.
Yes, I think their statement said, the South African Human Rights Commission incorrectly and ignorantly labeled Malema and failed to appreciate political commentary in its metaphorical, literary, and historical sense, and was falling into a trap at the altar of the egos and fragility of whiteness, which...
Yes, there you go.
Load of gobbledygook.
Yes, that's going to put you in your place. But also, like, this case is different from the Kill the Boer one, I guess, because, you know, that ruling was... But that was very deeply embedded in the context of culture and language and history. Right. And I think that was ultimately the justification of the courts that supported the right of Julius Malema to sing the song, saying, you know, it's a struggled legacy, et cetera, et cetera. It's not great, but I suppose we should allow it. And this wasn't the case here. I think this falls outside that definition.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a revolution demands at some point there must be killing, because killing is part of a revolutionary act. That is, you know, so vague and so legitimizing of violence in its kind of totality that I think this really, you know, he really did push it here, and I'm not surprised that the court did find against him. It's also interesting, you know, one of the complaints about hate speech laws is that they can be sort of applied inconsistently, right? If you're politically favored, you can have them applied against you. And I think the South African Human Rights Commission, which is an institution I've been, you know, and the Equality Court, both institutions I've been very critical of in the past myself, recognized that, you know, if only white racists are charged on hate under hate speech laws, then the law is going to delegitimize itself. It's going to be seen as just a sort of political tool. And I think perhaps that's one of the reasons why they decided to take up this case, was they do believe in hate speech laws. And if you have a hate speech law, it needs to be fairly applied. Andile Mkhithama, I don't know what to call, I don't even know, he's an MK now, isn't he? Anyway, wherever he is, he has been... he was actually one of the first, I think, on the sort of EFF race nationalist side to point out that hate speech laws could be used against the EFF, which I don't think was really true up until now. But, you know, the only thing worse than a bad law is a bad law with a double standard in this case.
Yeah.
It's probably for the best that they did, that this case was brought against Malema, because, you know, similar comments by, you know, someone, the DA or the Freedom Front Plus had said something like this, you can only imagine the cases that will be brought against them. So not amazing, but I'm not going to be kept up at night by this, really. Let's just put it like that.
There's just one aspect that's interesting here, Nicholas, is that I've always wondered what the consequences of banning certain words, because it seems to be logical that if you ban one word, then you will eventually have to ban another one and another one and another one, and you'll end up with a very long list of banned words, and then your free speech isn't so free anymore. And in South Africa, we know that the K word is very unpopular and unspeakable. But I've long been expecting for the R word to join that list. And maybe in a kind of way, we're seeing that in this judgment, where I think the judge did talk about, you know, calling somebody a racist is very, very bad. You know, it sort of impugns their dignity, it harms their self-worth, it ruins their career prospects. It's like really, really bad. And so we might see that R word eventually being added to the list of unspeakable words. Who knows?
Yes, although, of course, the problem with that is people always find some new term.
Yes,
you know, it's
and
like,
that's why the list always gets longer, right?
Exactly. There's a fancy sociological name for this called the like euphemism treadmill or something, which is whenever you start using a new word to describe something, inevitably that term becomes people know what you're sort of getting at, and then people just find new words, and then those become tainted over time.
Yes.
And offensive. So yeah, no, it's always a bit of a difficult thing. But you know what, falsely calling someone a racist is, you know, something that should be taken, I think, more seriously, because you know, racism is morally abhorrent, and accusing people of doing something morally abhorrent who have not necessarily done something morally abhorrent is wrong and should be considered that. And yeah, maybe we are getting to a better place on that front, but we'll have to see where this goes. Who knows what the appeal will produce? Maybe Malema will manage to claw back his situation. Okay, let's move on to our next story. Sakalika has decided to take legal action against NHI, saying it's unaffordable and unviable in South Africa's economic climate. They've asked the Pretoria High Court to declare the act unconstitutional and invalid and set it aside. Sakalika has pointed out the enormous amount of money that would be needed to actually implement the NHI, the National Health Insurance Scheme, it would require, in their words, an unthinkable 30% increase in income tax rates. They point out that a 2% increase in VAT was not accepted through Parliament recently. And that just shows that it's, you know, politically speaking, it's just impossible to raise taxes this much. They said, quote, if government tried to fund the NHI out of existing taxes and borrowing, it would have to make debilitating cuts to other government services and spending obligations and raise government borrowing from already unsustainable levels. Sakalika is joining a number of other court cases. I think the Board of Healthcare Funders, I think is the group's name, has recently opened a second court case against NHI. They opened their first court case at the Pretoria High Court a while ago, but they just this week opened one against the NHI on constitutional grounds, saying that Parliament didn't properly examine the process. At the same time, the Health Minister, Aron Motsoaledi, has tried to sort of hit back against all of this, asking the courts to suspend all of these court challenges until such a time as a previous court challenge has been dealt with. So it's all getting very messy and very gross. And the bottom line does look like, at the moment, NHI is not going to be implemented, even though it is the law of the land. It doesn't seem to have gotten nearly enough funding to actually start it being implemented in the latest budget. And it's facing all these legal challenges. What do you make of that, John? You know, what is the sort of state of things now? Is this, you know, should we be saying, okay, well, this is fine. NHI is just sort of frozen in its tracks. We can breathe easy. Is this also got negative consequences? I don't know. What's your take away from this one?
I think that there's some positives and some negatives that come out of this. And the positive, obviously, is that, you know, the longer the actual implementation of a bad system like this is delayed, the better. Ultimately, if it's delayed forever, then that's best. If it never happens, that would be best. But the negative is that while there's still uncertainty over whether it will be implemented, it is already draining confidence out of the health system. Now, so if you're a doctor or a medical student wondering about your place in, you know, South Africa's healthcare system of the future, you don't quite know. You might say, well, you know, I'm working in private practice and I get paid by private medical insurances. That seems to be working kind of okay for now. But 5 years from now, will that still be true? So should I actually start building my career here in South Africa, or should I already start looking overseas? So it creates this the sense of instability and uncertainty within the entire system, amongst the professionals working in the system, but at the same time also amongst the privately insured people in South Africa. So currently, if you're in the, I think it's 16% of the population that have some form of private medical aid, I think value that very, very highly. But you know that the government wants to take that away from you. You can see, you know, that's why that law has been passed. It's written in that law in Section 33 that there's not really a role for private medical aids, not a proper one. And that somewhere down the road, if NHI is implemented, that is going away. Like you won't have your medical aid anymore. Your discovery is going to be gone. Your Benitas is going to be gone. Your whatever med scheme, Fed Health, or whatever scheme you're on is going to be gone. And you're going to work in a government system. The government will pay for your medical expenses, but the service is likely to be closer to what you get currently if you go to a public hospital than what you get currently if you go to a private hospital. And so if you're beginning in your career as a young professional, again, you're going to ask the question and you'll say, should I like stick around and wait and see if it's coming or it's not coming? Or should I pull the trigger now, try to find my way out of the country, take my skills to a different place where there's a better healthcare system? And it's that uncertainty that's the problem here. So even though the delaying is good, ultimately it really does need to be defeated decisively so that the kinds of people that are needed to make our healthcare system work make the decision to stay here rather than pack their bags and leave. And I think in that context, it's quite helpful to point out a bit of research that Sakalich, I think, did in the context of this case, where they said, well, let's look at other countries that have introduced a similar kind of system, so a single-payer system, where the state manages all the money. And they find that South Africa's GDP per capita was just 17% of the median of the countries they surveyed, and total employment was just half the median of the countries surveyed. And their logical conclusion from this, which I think is quite correct, which is that like there's not enough fiscal capacity, is what they call it. There's not enough people with the money to pay for something like this if you want to make it a single payer system. And therefore it is irrational, and therefore it should be overturned by the Constitutional Court. So yeah, let's hope that,
you can't
that
have
this
a,
legal
yeah. Mm-hmm. You can't have the European welfare state without European levels of wealth, which we do not have.
That's the point, exactly. And so I think we really hope that Sakalicha is successful, or one of the other six applicants, and that they are successful sooner rather than later. And I think that would be really good.
I think there's another downside as well to keeping this thing sort of frozen in place, which is that it prevents any opportunity for further reform. The status quo was okay for those who did have medical insurance, but it was not really great for those who didn't have. And you know, government hospitals are badly, you know, badly run across the board. There's huge amounts of corruption in them. But in some ways, even worse than that, is private healthcare has been prevented from expanding by some of government's regulations. And so while we've got NHI sort of stuck in place, frozen there as a maybe to be done at some point if we can find the money, sort of, you've kind of blocked the pipe of any other attempts to actually fix problems. So, you know, maybe the ANC gets a slightly more, you know, I don't know, they have a rush of blood to the head and decide they're going to allow low-cost medical aid schemes. You know, good luck with that, because you would also then have to kind of wind back all the way from NHI. So it's all just it's all just a bit of a disaster. But at the very least, it's not the implementation. Which I think is good, because I do believe that NHI would really crack up the cost. It would really destroy the quality of life for many people in the middle class in South Africa. And that would be perhaps fatal to the country, unfortunately.
Yeah, because I think it would undermine the fiscal base, right? So many of the taxpayers that government revenue depends on would leave.
Brain drain, all sorts of terrible things that would also follow as well. And that would be very difficult to recover from, because you'd have to basically win that middle. You'd have to either completely manufacture a new middle class, which takes many years, or you'd have to lure people back, which is difficult, particularly while you've got problems like crime, which are not going to be easy to solve, even if we had a much more effective government.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move on to our next one. Funding the education system, some interesting stuff going on in education funding at the moment. The first one is that the DA Minister of Basic Education, Siviwe Gorube, has said that she is looking at reforming the quintile system, which currently determines how schools are given money by the government. All public schools are categorized into one of five groups, quintiles 1 to 5. And these are based on the community's income stats. Schools that are in the lower quintiles, 1 to 3, get allocated a lot more money per pupil per year, while those in the higher income receive much less money, the idea being that they can raise money from charging school fees and things from the parents of the kids who go to those schools. But this is quite a rocky and bureaucratic way of doing things. There's often all sorts of complications. You know, for example, parents from poorer areas might try to send their kids to school in richer areas because, you know, the education in a lot of those schools is better. So you get lots of parents who don't who can't really afford to pay the school fees, but are still, you know, sort of given a place. Sometimes the quintile is incorrect. The stats are old, or it just doesn't reflect the situation of the school properly. As the minister said, quote, too many schools face misclassification, inadequate per pupil allocations, unpredictable procurement of learning and teaching support materials, and persistent infrastructure backlogs. She specifically mentioned Glen Vista High School in the south of Joburg, which is classified as quintile 5 school, but is not, you know, it should be one of the wealthiest schools according to the sort of government rating system, but is not in reality. We must look at how the quintile system is being applied in assisting schools and the alternatives. South African communities are diverse and the profile of communities has changed significantly, so you can't still be hanging on that. There should be children who have access to school nutrition programs, for instance. It really does affect those learners. So that seems to me like a positive development. At the same time, NASFAS is basically facing a huge shortage. NASFAS is the National Students Financial Aid Scheme. This helps to pay for people's university education if they can't afford it. It's been badly managed for a long time and often doesn't fully pay out allocations or loans to students, or it sort of cuts them off halfway. And it's revealed that it now has a 10.5 billion rand budget shortfall for the 2025 academic year, which has resulted, for example, in some students who were doing okay at university being unable to register for a second semester. And a lot of others are left in financial limbo. So, John, let's kind of take this all together. Education funding, you know, it's interesting to me on the NASFAS front, at least, that Zuma did promise the whole population free university education. You know, fees must fall. This was a big issue. And then it was so unfeasible, the whole thing just sort of withered away. People just grumble about it from time to time. You know, what do you make of all this?
Yeah, so I think the big picture is that education is sort of the behemoth that's hard to understand. It is such a big part of not just society but also of the economy, right? So if you get education right, then you've got a chance of getting the economy right. So it's really, really important to do that. But most people's eyes just glaze over when you talk about education reform because it's so complicated and it's about schools and so on. But it's critically important. And what leapt out at me looking at the story about the quintiles and Siviwe Gorube's reforms in the quintile system is that the article we were looking at provides actual numbers. So it says that schools classified as quintiles 1, 2, 3, which are lower income schools, I allocated 1,754 rand per pupil. So you can actually see some actual numbers. And we've long argued that the way to fix the education system is through education vouchers. And rather than having a top-down system where, you know, you try to figure out which areas need which classrooms and how to get the school books to the school and how to prevent the windows from being broken during holiday time, you know, all of that stuff is really complicated to do in a centrally managed fashion. What would be much better would be actually to take this huge education department budget, break it down into smaller parts, and then give parents of school going children a share of that money and say, you know, you are a low income family, therefore you're getting, you know, 1500 rand per month voucher, which you can take to any school you like. You can go to a Karo school, you can go to an Adotech school, to a state school, private school, whatever you like. You can spend it wherever you want. And then you leave it up to the school itself to figure out how it uses that money. Does it use it to paint the roof? Does it use it to fix the fences? Does it use it to employ better teachers? It gets to choose. But it has to make decisions that are appealing to those students bringing those vouchers. It has to do it on a commercial, competitive basis. And that is probably the one thing that would be the quickest to improve our education system.
Right. And if the school is turning a blind eye to problems, letting teachers abuse students, do all sorts of things that schools in South Africa routinely get accused of doing, the parents can say, well, you're not getting my voucher. And even the poorest parent would be able to have some sort of real purchasing power in the sense of how they negotiate with the school then.
Yeah.
Would create pressures to perform better. That's definitely, I think, the way we should go. And while it's important, I think there are definitely improvements the minister could make to make the education system less cumbersome and bureaucratic and reform the quintiles. You know, it's still going to be dealing with the problems with that overly centralized system.
There's another aspect here, Nicholas, which is that this quintile system sort of measures income by area, which is a really weird approach. It's sort of assuming that everybody who's in like a quintile 5 area is equally wealthy and everybody who's in a quintile 1 area is equally poor. And obviously that's not true. Like you'll have mixed income levels in any given area, geographic area. And that is why like a system that focuses on individual means testing would be much better, because you'd say, we want to know whether you as a family can afford. And if you can't afford school fees, then you should get a voucher that helps you to pay school fees. That would be a much better approach. So again, it's sort of, you know, putting the spending power and the decision-making power in the hands of the parents, you know, at the level where the impact is felt, where a sense of ownership about education facilities can be created, rather than leaving it in the hand of an education department or, you know, some bureaucrat who makes the decision over where the money goes.
Right. And then you add to, you know, for example, the problems that like StatsSA has had in collecting data on the country. We know the last census was, you know, a big mess and had all sorts of problems with it. And then you sort of are using this data as the basis to try and kind of organize the entire system. It's not going to work. You know, this is part of the problem is that at a certain point, it's not even an ideological debate about whether the state should have a larger or a smaller role. If the state just doesn't have the capacity, as our colleague Terence Corrigan often points out, it can't pretend to be a developmental state until it improves capacity. And I think that's the point that we're increasingly at, also even in education, which is that the state doesn't have the capacity. So we need to look for alternatives. Even if you think that the private sector is the most evilest thing since Skeletor, you really need to actually start considering alternatives, because the situation is dire and this can affect the lives of millions.
Yeah.
Okay. That is all the time we have for today. We hope you found the show interesting, and we will be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend, the live show, Fridays, 1:30. See you there. Cheers, everyone.
The Daily Friend Show and the Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.